All right, so I got something that's kind of a joke, but actually it's good advice. So here's the opening thing. Why do people tend to side with those that are more emotional?
I don't know. Why?
Because the crazy people are most likely to come after you with a hatchet.
Well, yeah. The villagers are angry.
So, actually, I marked this off because somebody was using it to talk about, the crazy people that we deal with all the time, and they passed it along to me. I should have written down who said it and where I got it from and stuff like that. But I put it in my notes ages ago, and I just rediscovered it just now. But I don't know. I think there's so much truth to that.
It is true, but it's hard to say who's the crazy one and who isn't. You know, I mean, if nature has its way, the crazy types, the people that need to be beaten up with an axe, are the ones that go out of the gene pool.
I think this is where we have logic and reason on one hand, which most people are not persuaded by logic and reason. I would say 95% of the population are not really. They don't really buy into logic reason. They say that they are. They'll say that this is their thing, but really what is far more persuasive to them is fallacy. And this would be something like a person is crying and so therefore they must be right because they're feeling so much emotion. And I don't know, I must be a horrible and callous person because there have been many, many occasions where I'm Mr. Logic and Reason and I'm in an office and there is, and it's always been a woman, standing in my office or I'm in her office or whatever and the tears are flowing and I am not persuaded or moved by the tears. And I suppose that I should be saying, there. You know, I will change everything now because of the tears.
Like an old 50s movie. There, madam.
Yeah. Either that or it's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm such a fucking asshole. I don't know what I was thinking. You know, I'm not that way at all, which is, I think, why I kept getting jobs. And instead I will stand there and I'll look at them and I'll wait until they're done. And then it's like, now can we move on?
So you're telling me you got the job as the axe man? Is that what it was?
I did sometimes play an axe man.
Oh, I gotcha.
And
because a lot of people, when they're running a business, they hate that part. And so the part they want to hire somebody to come in and be the bad guy.
See, I don't know. I kind of feel like... I would go in and my job, towards the end of my career as a software engineer, and it's not like I really got all that tired of it. It's more like I just got so bit by the permaculture bug. I have to do this. I mean, you know, things have to be mended and I have to leap out of my chair and move in this direction. And so I ended up leaving that behind, but I still have calls from people saying, hey, can you come and do what you do? And in fact, it's awesome when they say that.
Well, it is, yes. Well, you know, it's funny because I'm in the same boat. I mean, we were talking earlier and I periodically have to drop everything and do that stuff that makes me money. But I'm, you know, always trying to get back out into the garden or into a project where I'm trying to create something that grows and lives and does it all by itself and is amazing, you know.
So my job was to improve velocity. Usually what I got hired for was things like the project is floundering and we can't, this project cannot flounder. So like, I think the first time I worked for Digital Globe, they had a component that, like, the rocket's going to launch. And they had a component for which the developers, the team, was given 6 months, and I was hired on the sixth month, and they were only 20% done. And so then we got it done on time. But it was hard.
Wow.
And But that's kind of the thing that I do. And then later, I came. They hired me back twice more. And the last time, it's like, okay, the whole department here, the whole department, do what you do. But anyways, the key is that there were several occasions, and at least twice at Digital Globe that I'm aware of, where there were tears, and it was just a river of tears, and I don't know. I did not feel bad. I just stood there because I must be a horrible, wicked person. And I just stood there and I waited until they were done. And then it's like, we have a rocket to launch, and tears are not part of what makes the rocket go up.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, I don't know, I'm a callous, nasty ass. And you're right. And it's not so much that I'm firing people. It's more like, these people over here, these 70 engineers are getting their shit done. These 10 over here, I don't know, you know, each one has a story, but the bottom line is they're not producing anything. And so here's what I want to do is I want to get rid of those 10 people, and I want to get in 10 new people. And so that's kind of how it was played. You know, that kind of thing is what I is you know, and I didn't actually do, and like a Digital Globe, I didn't do any direct firing. That was not my job. But there were so I'm going off on a tangent, and I need to rope it back.
Right.
The joke I thought was good, you know, crazy people, and I think it's very important to note that this is what moves our society, and yet I just cannot comprehend it. It's something that mystifies me, and I guess I'm a callous ass.
Well,
so we're going to actually talk about Sepp Holzer's permaculture, and I'm here today with Alex, and is it Alex Ojeda? Is that right?
That's really darn close.
Really close, okay.
Actually, no.
No, I'm wrong.
That's totally fine in the whole Anglo-Saxon pronunciation of it, and you got the J as an H sound. That's perfect, so I can go with that. But if you listen to my father say it, it's Ojeda.
Oh, geez, I'm not doing that.
So, you know, and that, hey, that might be wrong somewhere, too. You never know.
It turns out I'm disrespectful to other cultures, too.
Hey, there you go. As long as they don't come at you with an axe and a torch, you're okay, right?
So, Ojeda?
Yeah, yep. It's funny, the Ojeda family came over here with Amerigo Vespucci, so if you want to go look that up, you can see how to spell it. Ojeda.
You know, one of the questions that I get a lot is, am I related to Will Wheaton? And I got an email yesterday asking if I'm related to this other Wheaton person.
And who's Will Wheaton? I remember the name.
He was in the movie Stand By Me, and then for a while he was in the Star Trek The Next Generation. He was the boy genius.
I remember that now, yep.
Yeah, and then more recently he's been in The Big Bang Theory.
Oh, really? Wow.
As himself. So the character that I think is the funniest, which is one of the primary characters, Sheldon,
right,
is this physicist geek. And so Will Wheaton, the last I saw Will Wheaton was his arch nemesis, but I haven't seen as much of this show as I probably should, I suppose.
Well, you know, the thing about that character, not to get further off the track, but the thing about that character is for most people that liked Star Trek got really tired of seeing his character on that show saving the day over and over and over again. So it was sort of this, oh, another one of the Wesley, whatever his name was, Crusher, you know, saves the world episodes. So, yeah, it's probably his negative karma for that part.
Right. Maybe so. Although I understand, like, in certain circles, he's, like, quite the celebrity. He's done, I mean, like, he's like a new celebrity with game people, I think, people who play video games. But I once exchanged email with him.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I was working a contract down in San Diego and in my spare time I was doing a fair amount of that geocaching. And it turns out Will Wheaton also does a lot of geocaching, so I don't know whether he found one of my caches or I found one of his or what. And so we exchanged some emails. So, but hey, more trivia.
Right.
Actually, we've got I kind of think that today's topic is like one of the most awesome topics in all of permaculture, in that it's doing things so very differently from convention and having such phenomenally awesome success. So we're going to talk about how Sepp Holzer manages his fruit trees, and part of this includes, I mean, so you got to keep in mind that he's growing fruit trees, and he's growing varieties of fruit, including citrus, in an area where, in theory, he's not going to be able to grow any of this stuff, or hardly any of this stuff. So here in Montana, for example, we can grow cherry trees near Flathead Lake, but you get away from Flathead Lake, and most people struggle to grow cherry trees. And it's pretty much unheard of. And you can grow a cherry tree for like maybe 5 or 10 years, but then we'll get that big freeze that comes once every 5 or 10 years, and then your tree is gone.
Whoa.
So... So basically, Holzer talks in this chapter a great deal about how to take wimpy trees and make them super durable. And as he talks about, you know, what conventional ag says to do and what he was taught when he went, because he went to school, he went to ag school, and so then he shares what he was taught in ag school, and then he went and he was then ashamed of what he had done before. And then he did the ag school stuff, and almost everything he touched died.
When I read that line, I kind of sympathized with him. I remember basically you look at everybody else's gardens, and you look at all their the horticultural centers and all the gardening centers and things and the nurseries, and you say, wow, everything is so pretty and designed and artsy and this and that. And then you come back to your own garden, which is all done permaculture style, and it looks like the woods. And, you know, people come over and they go, so what's going on here, you know, and that kind of thing. And then you just say to yourself, well, maybe I should tidy it up. Maybe I need to cut this back and do this and do that. You start to feel embarrassed about it. And then I completely agree with what he's saying. When you let it just do what nature wants to do, then things get amazing and you don't even have to do anything. I mean, you know, you do very little. You put it out there and you just watch the fight happen, you know. So...
Right. So I think that let's dive in. I mean, Alex, this is the first time you've been on a podcast with me, and I know we're jumping into some of the stuff here, but I know you've listened to all of my podcasts.
I'm 100%er.
So I normally never ever write in a book. But because I feel like, you know, there's going to be a lot of people listening to the podcast and stuff, then I am taking a pencil and, you know, with the idea that I could erase it if I wanted to.
Sure.
And I'm marking out little fragments to convey. I am concerned about conveying more than 10%. I kind of just – I'm not sure what the law is in this space, but I think conveying more than 10% is probably disrespectful to the author, the publisher, etc. So I'm trying really hard. And it's like this is yet another chunk of the book that is very rich. There's a ton of – well, I'll try to mention it as we go along, like what it is that I'm skipping. And you're going to have to buy the book. Oh, in fact, now – this is a good time to mention. So I imagine you got your book from Chelsea Green, right?
Chelsea Green. You know, my wife actually ordered this book, so it's possible. But she ordered.
You look on the back.
She ordered this, and she ordered Rebel Farmer. So at the same time, this is so, Chelsea Green Publishing. Yeah, White River Junction, Vermont. Okay. Right.
There you go. So mine is from Permanent Publications.
Ooh, you're special.
Yes, indeed I am.
Indeed I am.
I'm glad we had this chat.
There, young man.
So I feel like it's important to mention that the book is available at permaculture.co.uk, and they sell it there. I mean, this is actually Maddie Harlan's outfit. Which worked it out, which spent years working it out with Sepp to get this book translated to English.
Oh, wow.
So for everybody in Europe and whatnot, and, you know, make sure to go out to permaculture.co.uk and buy it. And then the ones that you have is from Chelsea Green, which is a United States thing. And so Maddie Harlan worked it out with Chelsea Green. So I think that if you get the Chelsea Green copy, I'm pretty sure some money's got to go back to Maddie, but probably not as much.
Gotcha.
But anyway, so I want to mention these two things. And of course, I've got like a book, permaculture books link at the bottom of every page at permies.com that will take you to a place where if you click on that stuff and buy books, I get a kickback of like a dollar or something like that. But that goes to Amazon. But anyway, Chelsea Green supplied a copy for this project, but they gave it to Kelda. And Kelda is like too swamped now, and the Sepulcher event's coming up. So we're out of time. We got to race. And
right.
So fortunately, I was talking to you on the phone yesterday, and we're talking about graphics, because you've done all the new awesome logo images out at permies.com, and you're putting together the cool new T-shirts.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
You're the artist and the T-shirt guy.
Mm-hmm, and the T-shirts are being printed very shortly, so that'll be wonderful to get those out.
Yes. Hopefully I'll be able to give one to Sep, although he doesn't speak in English, so he'll have no idea what it says. But I imagine. So we've got two T-shirts coming. One of them says, they're both that weeds design, and the one I like says, weeds, Mother Nature refuses to be your personal bitch.
Right.
And then there's this other one for the other people.
For the people who want to be around their grandma wearing the shirt. You know.
Right.
The one that's been censored for your listening pleasure, you know, that kind of thing.
And that one says, weeds, resistance is fertile, is that right?
That's right.
Which, Helen Attow, when I told her that, she says she wants one, and she says that she would wear it every other day of her life.
Wow.
Because she says that was her motto for years. Like, she said that all the time.
Oh.
And she explained to me that I said, you know where it comes from, don't you? And she's kind of like, huh, what? And it's like, well, it's from the Borg. It's, you know, and she's like, oh, right, yeah. See, it was like 20 years ago. Because wasn't it the Next Generation with the Borg? Wasn't that 20 years ago?
It's been a long time. It's crazy how long it's been.
And so apparently she knew somebody that was big into the Star Trek thing, and so she heard
the
that.
The theme of this podcast, by the way, must be Star Trek.
Oh, you think we could do that?
Yeah, there you go. Fruit trees. So somehow that's Star Trek.
I got dibs on being Picard.
There you go. I will be now, the little bald guy from the first one that has Tranya, and he makes it from fruit off of a tree in Austria. So anyway, I don't know.
What?
Oh, gosh, you don't remember. What is it? Baylock? Baylock? It's actually Ron Howard's little brother, Clint Howard. Okay, now we're getting way too off the track. Let's get back into this.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh, well, I am a true Trek geek, so you got to watch out. I kind of end with The Next Generation. After that, it's over my head. So, but,
I watched the Voyager one. I thought that one was good.
Yeah.
I kind of watched some of the Deep Space Nine, and I was kind of like,
anything with Shatner or Patrick Stewart in it, I've already seen all their movies and all their other stuff. They're just totally awesome dudes to me. So,
I really enjoyed the series a long time ago, Boston Legal, but it was mostly because of that guy that was played by James Spader, but you know. Anyway, all right. Yeah, we are getting off topic. Well, wait a minute. Now I'm confused though. Who is the guy that you apparently are?
Oh, what is his name? Baylock or something like that. He says, gentlemen, this is Tranya. And he gives them this drink, you know. I hope you relish it as much as I, you know, and all the crazy stuff. But it's literally Clint Howard as a little tiny kid playing this scene. And he's supposed to be the scary guy. You see it in the beginning of the credits all the time. He's the long-faced, scary alien. And then when they beam over, they find out it's some little sweet kid, you know. Oh, he's not a kid. He's an older guy, but he's, you know, tiny and munchkinish and cute and cuddly.
Is this with the original Star Trek series?
Yeah. The one where they have flared bottom pants and the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I watched those so long ago, and I probably didn't even see all of them. And so I'm sorry, I can't remember them. I liked The Next Generation with Picard. I thought Picard was awesome.
Oh well, they definitely stepped it up with that episode, with that show. That's for sure.
Yeah, man, that was just incredible.
Well, you know, the ones in the '60s, what they were doing then was amazing, and what they did in the, what was this, the '90s? That was amazing.
Yeah.
So you know, but they just haven't been amazing since. So this is why it's kind of off my radar.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, should we go back to talking about Sepp Holter? Now I know why you wanted to do a Star Trek theme for this. Because you're a Trekkie.
No.
Own any of the uniforms?
No. But you had started. You started it, man, with the whole Will Wheaton thing. Come on.
Oh, that's right. I did.
Okay,
that's right.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Cheers. I am.
Okay.
Because you did the Resistance is Fertile.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, combining Resistance. Okay. All right. You're right. We're ending up with this theme, and it's accidental. All right. So, Sepp Holter's Permaculture. We're on page 104. We are probably about halfway through the book. And of course, what an awesome and thick, rich book it has been. It is so amazing. And here in a little bit, we're going to talk about the bone sauce. So, the first bit I've got marked out says, fruit trees are also very well suited to growing in paddocks where livestock is kept because they're an excellent source of food. The windfall fruit make an especially good source of high-quality feed for pigs. So I think that this is a great time to point out that this, like, and in fact, as I'm reading through this, I'm just thinking, like, this is almost, like this whole segment that we've read is almost exactly. I mean, it's like Fukuoka could have written this.
That's exactly what I thought. Yep.
So now, have you read his One Straw Revolution?
Oh yeah, and you know, it's funny because a lot of this in this whole chapter, at least, is very, very Fukuoka-ish. You know, I keep thinking to myself, this is exactly what Fukuoka would have done, and this is what he did, and I'm very impressed with it.
Yeah, and it's like these guys were developing their techniques, and they're both geniuses, and they're coming to the same conclusions.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is all right. The next part is wood from fruit trees, mostly wild fruit trees, and especially from pear and cherry trees, is highly valued as top quality joinery and industrial timber. The roots are very popular with artists because the burl wood can be used to make unique and beautifully shaped objects, such as wood carvings or other works of art. So, in Washington State, one permaculture farm that I visited is Wild Thyme Farm. And when I look at their polycultures, it's kind of like, really, this is it? This is their polyculture? It's far too tidy for my tastes. However, the guy that owns this chunk of land, John, I think his name is John, pretty sure his name is John, it seems to me like he's far more bonkers about lumber. So he's got himself a sawmill, and then he goes across to his land and takes care of his trees, and then he'll drop a tree periodically. And then he is finding those markets where it's like he'll get just the perfect piece of lumber from a tree, and he'll dry it perfectly, and he'll sell it for $4,000, like a single plank, $4,000. Or he'll get a piece of burl wood or the right kind of root wood or something like that, and he'll sell it for $1,000. And it's kind of like, these chunks of wood aren't all that large, but the artists who are going to turn around and monkey with it and then sell it for like $15,000 or $30,000, for them, it's totally worth it.
Well, and
to start off with a good piece of wood that's been handled by effectively a lumberman who is a bit of an artist himself.
Well, when you think about doing like rebuilding classic and or ancient buildings. You know, you have to have specific pieces of wood cut to specific dimensions and made out of a specific tree. You know, it seems that that would be beyond invaluable. I mean, just to be able to get that.
Yes, I agree. And on top of that, the Alone in the Wilderness, that movie where that guy is going up into Alaska, and he makes his own little cabin, and then he goes and he grabs some root wood, and he carves himself up some hinges for his front door.
Ooh, I haven't seen that one. That sounds pretty neat.
Really?
Yeah.
Dude. Oh, yeah. We gotta somehow get you hooked up with that, and we'll do a podcast about
that. There you go. What's this called again?
That. It's called Alone in the Wilderness. It's this guy, Dick Prinicky. He's like a superhero guy. But he videos this in like 1969 or something.
Right. Well,
and so it's all film, you know.
Film.
Yeah. And he's got like some kind of little home camera or something, and he's videos himself. Although at one point in time, I mean, through most of the movie, you get the idea that he's got the video camera going, or not video camera, the film camera going, and then he does his thing, and then he must turn it on and off himself, and then it gets edited up later or something. But there's only one point in the whole thing where the camera pans with him, so somebody must be on the other end of the camera. But the rest of the time, he's all alone up there.
So that was the whole production cost, was he hired somebody to come pan that one shot for him.
Yeah. Well, he does talk about how there's a plane that comes in once a month to bring him some supplies.
Oh, there you go. That's what it is. Hey, can you do me a favor and pan this camera for 5 minutes?
But basically, it's probably about 40 to 45 minutes of the movie is him showing up in the spring. And it's like, who knows how many miles it is away, but he like gets his stuff there in a canoe, and then he builds a cabin. It's like, okay, oh, I think I'll build it here. And then he starts whittling up some logs, and he builds himself a cabin, puts a green roof on it, and you know, it takes him the better part of the summer. And then, of course, he's got to get food, too, while he's up there. So he does a little fishing, a little hunting. Little wildcrafting, I'm sure. When the plane comes into the lake once and brings him supplies, they bring him some rhubarb culms, and so he plants some rhubarb. One of the few things that will grow in Alaska.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, he's finally got, and then winter's setting in towards the end, and he's got to build himself a fireplace.
Whoa.
It's because it's cold.
Well, I hope he's been chopping wood all summer long. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah. Oh, this guy's got. I mean, the other thing is he's like 50 years old, but he's got like these freaky big muscles. I mean, this guy is in shape, man.
Yeah.
And he knows what the hell he's doing.
Well, you know, it's starting to sound familiar. This whole idea of this guy's project. I gotta check this out. Well, I love hearing about people making hinges out of wood and things like that. Things that are like right there on the property. You know, everything you need is right where you're standing. That kind of concept, you know.
Right. He shows up with like the metal parts of a bunch of hand tools, and then the first thing he has to do is whittle himself up a bunch of handles for his tools.
Oh wow!
In order to be able to like, you know, move on to the next step. And it's an awesome movie.
I love that.
It's just amazing. We'll do a podcast about it.
Yeah, there you
we'll
go.
We'll watch it, podcast, because it is awesome. all right. As my trees are not sprayed with pesticides, fertilized, watered, or pruned, they must develop into hardy and independent trees in order to grow and thrive under these conditions.
Right. And I love that, because he's doing the exact opposite of what most people are doing. Most people are saying, well, we're going to grow these trees the way we want them, and then when they're all sick and weak, we're going to like coddle them and do everything to take care of them. And he's saying, forget that. I'm going to like send these trees through boot camp, and then I'm going to put them out here in the wilderness, and they're going to be amazing, you know?
Right, right. And I think, you know, and this is a big slice of how permaculture works, too, is it's like, if the tree does not survive, then it was never meant to be there anyway.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
So, you know, and then the ones that you know, do survive and do well, I mean, they have to do well. But, I mean, there's so much more to it. But it's like, you know, basically, it's like boot camp is a great way to think of it. Let's make these trees tough.
Right.
So, all right. So this is a section called, from the first section is, this is chapter 3, possible uses, and there's, on the last paragraph out of all this, now am I skipping ahead, have you marked off anything out of here?
I had written a few notes, so like the whole idea that when the fruit falls out of the trees, if there's nothing there to eat it, it kind of rots the roots or does something. Which I always find that odd, because I always assume that microorganisms just devour that stuff. But hey, if it's a problem, you know, you've heard the term silvopasture, I'm sure. And what they basically do is they run animals between rows of trees. And when fruit falls out of the trees, the animals eat it, and that takes care of the trees. So it's one of those symbiotic relationships that happens here with the tree, the plant life, and the animals. And so when he was talking about this, I just said to myself, well, there, here you go. I mean, it's absolutely perfect. And he's using his terraces as silvopasture lanes, basically.
Absolutely, and it is a pretty common organic practice, and this would be an organic practice where you don't have animals, and the practice is that when the fruit falls on the ground and you're not going to eat it, then you need to pick it up and compost it. Otherwise, what happens is that the bugs get into it, and then they just go up into the tree and make the tree sad.
Right, right, right. So if you don't have pigs, you must do the pig's work. I got you.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. The last paragraph out of this section is, as the trees grow in a mixed culture, they blossom at different times, which means that a complete crop failure is prevented if the climatic conditions are unfavorable, such as late frost. This diversity and the different flowering times ensures that there is plenty of pollen available for the blossoms to be pollinated, which will ensure a good yield of fruit. So now I think that and from this, what he's talking about is that he's got trees at all kinds of elevations, and so some things it's going to be colder, and some things it's going to be a little bit warmer. But on top of that, lots and lots of different varieties of the same species, so that way they'll blossom at different times. So that way there's, you know, going to be, if you get a late frost, but then these other, some of these varieties actually blossom much later, then everything will work out fine. You know, you'll always have cherries every year.
Well, and reading this, you kind of notice that he talks about how down in the lowlands you have this kind, you know, X fruit tree blossoms at this month, and then up in the Kramaterhof where he is, it actually seems to fruit a month later or maybe even a month earlier, depending upon what he's talking about. And then you realize that it may even be a climatic change that causes it to change. And then probably with his microclimates that are going on in his terraces, he could have the same variety of tree, and I don't know, maybe I'm totally wrong, what do you think? Same variety of tree in different places on his farm, and it's going to even be blossoming at different times.
Yes.
Gotcha. So yes. Different varieties, same varieties, mm-hmm. In different microclimates.
All of them.
Yeah.
All of them. I mean, the more diversity, the better. And not only that, but it's like, not only has he got different elevations going on, but he's got like different microclimates of different kinds going on. And so then the bottom line is that any given year, probably a quarter, maybe a third of your fruit trees bear no fruit because, you know, there was a late frost or something that nailed the blossoms. But the rest of them are going to do great. So it's like, and then certain years the frost is going to be down there, certain years there's something else going on up here, but with lots of diversity, you've got an insured harvest.
Right.
All right. So on to the next section. The wrong way to cultivate fruit trees.
I love that.
And I think the wrong way, and you know what, I'm just going to read the first paragraph because it kind of talks about this, and it's going to be what I was going to say. During my training to become an arborist at agricultural school, I learned that fruit trees should supposedly be pruned, fertilized, and sprayed with pesticides in order for them to grow well. We were also shown how to catch poison and gas voles to prevent them from damaging the fruit trees. It is shocking that these practices are still described in almost all textbooks today. Now, I have to remind folks, this is the wrong way to cultivate fruit trees.
Right. Lest somebody pull that sound bite out and say, this is what Paul Wheaton likes.
Yeah, this is the wrong way. Because, you know, and it's kind of like I went and re-attended because I did the Master Gardener training here in Missoula 16 years ago, and my instructor for all of it was Helen Attow. And so this last winter, I thought it would be awesome to try it again and do some fine-tuning and fill some gaps. And I thought Helen was teaching the whole thing again, only Helen only taught the first two classes. And not only, I mean, of course, I'm sure you well know, Helen and I don't agree on a lot of stuff. And I kind of like to think, and I'm really sure Helen never listens to any of my podcasts, not even the ones with her in it. So I can feel free to say anything I want.
Wow.
So I do think that Helen is changing her tune. She is, I mean, granted, she's the one who taught me 16 years ago, and she taught me a lot, and she is a great teacher, extremely knowledgeable, and at the same time, I think that I've gone out in the world, and there's a lot that I've learned, and I've come back and shared it with Helen, and at first, Helen was like, no, that's not true, and stuff like that, and now I think she's come a long ways.
Well, you know, you consider that organic farming, I don't know about veganic farming, but organic farming is basically your standard, you know, commercial agriculture. So it's still doing a lot of the techniques that we don't agree with in commercial ag. And it's just not using pesticides and certain other things. Or maybe it's pesticides, but it's not going to be, you know, petroleum-based pesticides. But right. But the thing is, you know, like Fukuoka writes in his books, that every single time he has a success, it's when he doesn't do something. Like, in other words, he realizes that everything that we do in agriculture seems to be a Band-Aid over the last mistake we made. And so I do believe that people start to come to the same conclusions. Do you get where I'm coming from?
You know, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so here we've got, you know, she's doing the veganic thing, which is absolutely admirable and amazing, but it's still, you know, commercial ag. And then, well, it's organic.
I don't think, not veganic, organic.
Organic.
The organic. So she put in, last summer, she worked on a 2,000-acre, well, she ran a 2,000-acre organic farm in Colorado.
Right.
Yeah, and but at the same time, she kind of had this love-hate thing with it, you know. But what she really wants to do is not that. There was so much about it that she hated.
Right.
It was running against her grain.
Well,
kind
where
of
I'm
thing.
Going with this, though, is like if you look at Fukuoka and you look at Sepp Holzer and you see how they both came to the same conclusions in two totally different worlds, mm-hmm. It's almost as if the more thought you put into this, the more we all end up in, and I don't want to use permaculture as a term, but we all end up in the permaculture world. We all start ending up in a natural world where we're just looking at nature and saying, okay, tell me how to do this. You know?
Right.
And then you go, well, okay, that's the class right there in zone five, you know?
Well, I think the thing to do is that, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of the education going on in the zone five, and, you know, you can observe. But I still think that it is, if I go to this zone five that is in our imagination, I think that as a permaculturalist, I can make that be more.
Right.
I've got a lot of conflict when we talk about a zone five. Zone five has a function and a place, and really what I want to do is not go in there. I mean, that's kind of the idea. However, I do think that, you know, my zone one is going to have started off in theory as a Zone 5 like thing, and then I came and did my thing on it, and now it's like, shroomp, it's full of food, it's growing 10 times more lushness, and I need a better word than lushness, but that's what I keep going for.
I like it.
And so I just feel like there's 10 times more life per acre happening where I've been there fiddling with things than if nature were left alone. And I feel like that's what I'm supposed to do.
Well,
you know, as opposed to like, okay, there's nature and I'm going to sit in my rocking chair, and when I'm hungry, I'll go out into this 100-acre wood and, you know, get my food.
Right. Well, I think Zone 5 is supposed to be the control. So every time you mess something up, you go, okay, well, I'm going to look back at Zone 5 and get my lesson. But like a food forest is sort of like, I think what you're talking about, where you take a Zone 5 idea, but it's all food. You've basically massaged everything so that it fills those niches that happen in Zone 5, but everything's some kind of a productive plant. I mean, there's a reason for everything, not just, you know, honestly, Zone 5, there's a reason for everything. But you're trying to get those elements in there that are feeding you and feeding each other so it takes care of itself.
Have I mentioned on the podcast my whole thing about dial tone?
No. I don't think so.
Okay, so here's what I think. Here's my dial tone thing, and that is that a field of corn.
Oh, yes, you have mentioned that.
Okay, so a field of corn sounds like dial tone. I started. I can't stop now.
No, do.
Field of corn sounds like dial tone. A field that has never been touched by man sounds like static or white noise. And I believe that God put me here to create symphonies in seed and soil.
Right.
And so I think the Zone 5 is important, but that's going to be our white noise in contrast to the symphony. And the field of corn is not a symphony.
Nope.
I don't care what they say.
Nope.
That's dial tone. Yeah, it's producing so-called food.
Right.
You know, all right. So, we wandered off a bit again, which is okay. But the key is that this section is loaded with the conventional wisdom, and which is the stuff that they're currently conveying at the Master Gardener stuff right now, and some of this Helen might even advocate right now. Although I think that a year or two from now, Helen would probably not. I mean, I detect velocity in Helen towards a permaculture, towards Sepp Holzer stuff. And I know that I had her sit with me and watch one of Sepp Holzer's videos, and she's browsed through this book that we're holding right now, and she kind of she thinks there's a lot of good stuff in there, but she thinks a lot of it's bullshit. And I think, you know, and granted, you know, if Sepp Holzer and Helen Attow have an argument, I'm sorry, I'm siding with Sepp.
Well, you know, she can go visit the Kramerhof and see, you know, how it works, and then maybe it would be a completely different world for her. All of a sudden, the book makes so much more sense.
Well, she comes from a science background. Where I mean, and this is kind of like part of the where science has problems. I mean, basically, there's all these scientists, and they prove things, and they point at each other and say, "I have proven you wrong." "No, I've proven you wrong." "No, I've proven you wrong." So there's this constant bickering, and so and Helen, of course, has done her own research, but it's like the research that she's done is like not a full picture thing, but a lot of the research she's done is on the road. I mean, she studied with Fukuoka.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And yet, you know, she's like, when I try to talk about Fukuoka, she's like this authoritarian detractor.
Wow.
Because she says, well, no one's been able to duplicate what Fukuoka's done. And so basically, the way she says it, it sounds like, therefore, no one will ever be able to do it again. When Fukuoka died, we lost it all, and now we're all doomed to suck. And so I keep saying, if Fukuoka did it, the rest of us can do it. Plus, Sepp Holzer ain't dead, and he's doing it.
Right.
And granted, the metrics that I measure Sepp by are different than the metrics for Fukuoka. But Fukuoka did some things, and basically, you know, so Fukuoka was able to produce rice in the top 5% per acre, you know, for Japan. And it's kind of like, you know. And on for that same chunk of land, he brought barley also. But the key is it's like if Fukuoka wasn't in this position where he felt like he had to prove to these so-called scientists that his stuff works, if he wasn't so powerfully compelled to do that, then I can't help but think that he would not have grown it there that way. And he would instead be growing his grain more like what Sepp Holzer does, which is in patches, not in a great big field. Because I think Fukuoka's got like 11 acres or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's got like this big field of rice, which seems... Now, granted, it seems kind of monocropish, but of course, underneath the rice, there's like lots of other species of plants growing with the rice.
Right. It's sort of like when you're reading the Sepp Holzer book here, you realize that he's putting all these plants at the base of the tree to perform all these different functions. And so the rice plants in Fukuoka's field are basically fruit trees. You know, I mean, he's basically putting all the stuff at the base of them to take care of the ground and hold in the moisture and to provide the nutrients and to attract the right insects. And
but see, now it's better. But it's still a monocrop.
It is.
I mean, and it's not exactly a monocrop because it's got a diversity of species underneath it. But there's so many of the same species that that's a problem. And it's like, you know, so I can't help but think that Fukuoka was just trying to prove something. And it's kind of like, you know, that's... And so he proved it. He did it. He got it done. It's now proven. And so now, because he proved it, we don't have to. It's like he died for our sins.
Yeah, there you go.
So he proved it. So we don't have to. He took care of that. Now we can move forward with producing food the right way without having to try and prove shit to anybody.
Well, right. In other words, try to, you know, do a more natural version of the same thing using those techniques, but without such a monocrop.
Exactly. So now, back to what Sepp was writing, because there's other parts of this chapter that I need to convey, I had to leave some stuff out, but he starts going into stuff about how they put galvanized wire mesh into the holes wherever they would plant trees. This is the wrong way to cultivate fruit trees.
Right.
And this is the way that I hear so many people doing it, and it's like, you know, they want to keep the critters out, and it's like, man, this is such a bad idea in so many ways. And it's like, okay, yeah, moles and voles want to come and attack and whatever, and all these little whatever critters growing in the ground. And it's like, you know what? That isn't going to stop them. I mean, it will slow them down. But and then the other thing is like, what's going to happen when the tree roots start getting bigger than one of the holes in that thing?
Right.
You know, if you put some sort of mesh in there.
Well, it's going to restrict the tree root, is my guess.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's gonna cause all kinds of problems. And but he goes into all these details of all the things that they were told to do that you know, and it's like, man, I have heard that I don't know how many times as the right way, and Sepp's making it clear it is the wrong way. And so, but there's so much stuff here that's just like comedy after comedy after comedy of the things that you should not do, which, of course, are the things that are being advocated as what to do, that I just, you gotta buy the book and read the book.
Well, you know, it's funny because that, when I read that, I said, oh my goodness, that's exactly what's happened to me. So I went out to this local nursery and I bought these two lemon trees because I love these lemon trees, right? I put them in my front yard. I did everything they told me to do. You know, just what he's talking about in this book, scraping it out, you know, and making sure nothing grows around there, loaded up with water and fertilizer every month and constantly do this and do that. And these trees just sat there and looked dead all the time. And then I have these two friends that live in a regular suburban neighborhood, and they're putting a food forest in the front and the back. Their names are Val and Eli. These two people, I go over to their house, and their citrus trees are growing like weeds. And I said, okay, what are you doing? They told me. I came back to my house. I did one of my fruit trees that way and left the other one the other way. The one is amazing. Just what Seth's talking about, mulching all the way up to the trunk of the tree, putting in other plants, the whole nine yards. And now I've got something that looks like it's going to produce fruit this next year.
Now, I would not mulch right up next to the tree.
Well, I mean, I'm mulching up around the root ball is what I'm saying. Yeah,
okay.
You're right. Yeah, you can't let the bark get too wet too often or it's going to rot. I think I understand that part. Yeah.
I think this is a good point to let everybody know that you're not in Montana.
No, I'm in Florida, so it's nice and hot here, and the game changes.
Easier to grow lemons, and your local nursery actually sells lemon trees.
Right, like yours doesn't, and I won't get apple trees down here. Although there are a couple of varieties supposedly that will grow. I read what Seth's talking about, and I say, well, maybe I can figure out how down here to get something to be cooler. You know, and that'll be a nice challenge.
I think that would be a whole podcast that we could do sometime in the future, is to do something about how to make things cool.
Yeah, because let me tell you, it gets so hot that it literally shuts down all of the plant production out here. Unless you're out in the forest, you know, in which case everything seems to be fine.
So, but we'll come back to that later. I've got two more little bits out of this section, I think. Let's see. I got a couple more little bits to read out of this section. They are addicted to regular fertilizing and watering, and they are susceptible to scab, fungus, and frost. They are easily damaged by the wind or snow, and they are vulnerable to pests of every kind. According to the rules of these conventional methods, cultivating fruit trees at high altitudes should not be possible at all. So this is where I think, you know, your boot camp thing comes in. Once I had internalized the conventional methods, I became almost ashamed that I had a wilderness garden at home. And then he talks about how he practiced what he'd been taught. So this is his whole story about how he goes to ag school. He becomes ashamed of his wilderness garden, which is basically, that must be what he called it before he heard the word permaculture.
Right.
So basically, as a kid, as a teenager, he has his wilderness garden, and everything is awesome. And then he even goes around and helps his neighbors and stuff grow their gardens. And everybody is so happy with the Sepp Holzer touch, and everything is just, like, magically awesome. And then he goes to school, and then he comes home, and he becomes ashamed of his wilderness garden. Like, oh, I've done it all wrong. I trust my teachers at school, and so now I'm going to do it the way that they've told me. And you go, now that I've learned my lessons, and then he goes and he applies all this stuff to his garden, almost everything dies. And then he goes and he does it for some of his customers, some of his neighbors who've always loved the Sepp Holzer touch, and their stuff was pretty much destroyed also. And I think there was something like some woman said, "You're going to pay for that."
She was pissed.
"You've killed everything, you little bastard." So, and then I've got a part here. Thank heavens there were customers I had not visited that year, and so we're spared my, quote, expert advice,
right,
end quote. These customers were completely fine. I turned independent and healthy trees into dependent addicts, and my harsh pruning only mutilated them. It was a great piece of luck that my practical experiences helped me to find my way back to the right and natural path. Yay!
Yeah. You know what's awesome is that he was ever on that path to begin with.
Right. Oh, and I think that's what he's saying. And, of course, a big part of it is, you know, he just kind of stumbled into a lot of it through observation. It's like he didn't have a book. He didn't have anything. He just had this passion for growing things and fish and ponds. And he's just a kid, and he's just bonkers about it. And then it turns out that whatever he fooled with did better than his mom and dad. And then he goes off to school, and then all the stuff he learns in school makes stuff die.
You know, I don't really understand how these people get things to grow with all that knowledge. I mean, when immediately, within 1 year, he's killing things. You know, I mean, how does that work? How do you ever get any money or any business or anything with things not working so well? I mean, my trees didn't grow for almost 2 years.
Well, you know what? I kind of think that this is a brute force thing. You know, and it's like the whole thing about irrigation, the birth of irrigation. I'm sure I've done it in a past podcast, and it's kind of like, okay, clearly that plant doesn't have water.
Right.
Clearly that plant is suffering from a lack of water. I can tell. And so I'm going to get my bucket. I'm going to go down to the river and get some water and bring it back and give it to the plant. This is brute force.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make it. We're going to fix it. We're going to force it. If you see a potato plant covered in Colorado potato beetles, your thought is, I'm going to save the plant by getting rid of all the Colorado potato beetles. If you have a friend with cancer, your first thought is, I'm going to nuke the cancer. I'm going to cut my friend open and whittle it out. I will crush it. I mean, this is our natural first blush instinct on a way to fix things. And it seems like, you know, the far more educated, the far more intelligent, the far wiser approach is going to be, my friend got cancer because they were consuming, they were exposed to carcinogens. And so if I remove the carcinogen exposure and feed them good, healthy foods, then their own system will beat the cancer naturally.
Exactly. Yep. I'm sitting here kind of like shaking my head. Yes. Like, hell yeah, brother. Amen. You know,
amen.
Because, you know, what Sepp Holzer does is he comes to a cancer patient, because I love how he anthropomorphizes these fruit trees, because look at what's happening to us as humans eating the food that comes out of these gardens or out of this agriculture, not these gardens, but agriculture. It's sick and decrepit, and we're getting that way, too. But what Sepp Holzer would do is he would come in and say, you have cancer, so now I have to make your immune system tougher, and I have to make your body and your health better. I'm not going to go after the cancer. I'm going to go after the thing that's supposed to be controlling it for you.
I think the way that permaculture does it is like one step further, which sounds like crazy talk, which is to say, you have cancer? Well, you're supposed to have cancer. This is Mother Nature trying to fix the fact that there's like all these poisons here, and it's going to take you out so you don't reproduce.
It's a healing response. It grabs the toxins and localizes them and keeps them out of your system.
Yeah, this where the area you're in is so toxic, you shouldn't be here.
It waits until you move to another place, and then you start getting better food, and it says, okay, I have the materials I need to detox you, and then it starts to detox you slowly, and the tumor goes away.
So, when we go to the Colorado potato beetles, with the Colorado potato beetles, it's like, well, rather than going and trying to like, you know, hire an army to kill the Colorado potato beetles and nothing else, then it's kind of like, well, you know, you planted 40 acres of nothing but potatoes and you wiped out all other plants on this 40 acres. What did you think was going to happen? You're doing a monocrop, which is contrary to the way nature runs things. You know, this whole field is flat as a pancake. What did you think was going to happen?
You sent a flyer.
You came in, you fucked with nature.
Yeah.
What did you think was going to happen? So, and then, of course, so the brute force reaction is that I'm going to go to war with nature. Nature is these Colorado potato beetles, and I'm going to fuck up their shit. And so there's, you know, now what are, and even the organic techniques are like, well, what can I bring in the organic arsenal to kill Colorado potato beetles?
Right.
you know, and it's like, you know what, here's a thought. What if you had lumpy land and potatoes did not take up more than 5% of the land, and the 95% was like 50 other species of stuff? And so then if a potato beetle are getting on one potato plant, who cares? That potato plant wasn't supposed to be there. You know, something else will then do well there.
And
then over here we have a potato plant that's doing awesome, and there's no Colorado potato beetles on it at all.
And this is where we need to have thousands of Karameterhofs and less huge expanses of a particular produce provider. You know, like in other words, I have 1,000 acres of potatoes, and that's what I do. Well, if it was more like a market garden on every block in every neighborhood, or, you know, every other block in every neighborhood, you could actually have the same amount of each kind of produce, but it could all be intermixed with other things that are growing naturally and so supporting the garden itself. You know, right. But we've decided to do the exact opposite, and this is, I think, the big battle.
This podcast will be continued in part 2. If you like this sort of thing, come out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about Sepp Holzer, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.